position is they're not really on the left. They insist that they are, but I would actually agree inadvertently with the caller. I don't think those folks are actually leftists. Anyway, that's a perfect example of what I've been telling you guys about. We've got a great bonus show for you today. We will talk about the believed frontrunners for Joe Biden's Supreme Court pick. We're going to talk about the hilarity that has developed with Glenn Youngkin's tip line to snitch on teachers. It's actually hilarious. And we will talk about problems with the child tax credit, problems with the child tax credit in terms of it actually being distributed to people. We're going to talk about confusion around that and much more on today's bonus show. You can sign up at joinpacman.com to get instant access. We will see you then.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother. Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs. Bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
RCT, the inside from way out.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Forever.
there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a wholesome word.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Is provocative in and of itself. You are almost calling for this. You want it to happen.
As the U.S. and NATO allies send arms to Ukraine and Russia amasses troops on its border, can a war in Europe be averted? We'll speak to Medea Benjamin of Code Pink about how the peace movement is responding.
NATO should have been dissolved after the Cold War. Instead, it's an aggressive organization that's provoking this conflict. We have to not only say Ukraine should not be part of NATO, but NATO should be dissolved.
We'll also talk to peace activists in Belgium, the home of NATO, and Germany, which is refusing to send arms to Ukraine. And we'll talk to a Ukrainian sociologist who says the U.S. media is harming Ukraine by spreading hysteria about the crisis. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States and Russia clash Monday at the United Nations Security Council over the crisis in Ukraine. The U.S. accused Russia of preparing to invade Ukraine by amassing over 100,000 troops on its border. But Russia rejected the charge, claiming it was the United States and NATO who are trying to push Russia into war. This is Russia's U.N. ambassador.
Our Western colleagues are talking about the need for de-escalation. However, first and foremost, they themselves are whipping up tensions and rhetoric and are provoking escalation. The discussions about a threat of war is provocative in and of itself. You are almost calling for this. You want it to happen.
Last week, President Biden placed 8,500 U.S. troops on high alert. The U.S. and NATO allies are also shipping weapons to Ukraine. On the diplomatic front, U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken set to speak with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov by phone today. In Washington, U.S. senators are preparing to unveil a bill imposing what Senator Robert Menendez described as the mother of all sanctions targeting Putin, Russian banks, and other entities. We'll have more on the crisis over Ukraine after headlines. Chinese authorities say they've identified over 200 coronavirus infections among athletes and personnel involved in the Beijing Winter Olympics as China struggles to maintain its zero COVID strategy. The Winter Olympics opening ceremony will be Friday. Over the weekend, authorities sealed off several residential areas of Beijing where two locally transmitted COVID-19 cases were detected. In Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Monday he tested positive for coronavirus and will work from home. Trudeau, who received a booster shot in early January, reported no symptoms. He said two of his three school-aged children also tested positive and once again called on Canadians to get vaccinated. Over the weekend, thousands of protesters arrived in Ottawa to oppose vaccine mandates for truck drivers who cross the Canada-U.S. border. Trudeau said some of the protesters displayed Confederate flags, swastikas, and other symbols of hate.
There is always a right to protest peacefully, that I and others will defend fully as part of this democracy. There is not a right to incite violence, to perform acts of violence, or to spew hatred.
The number of daily coronavirus infections reported around the United States continues to fall rapidly from mid-January's peak, but remains higher than at any other point in the pandemic. More than 2,500 people are dying of COVID-19 each day, with the official U.S. death toll on pace to pass 900,000 in mid-February. Pfizer is preparing to request emergency use authorization for its vaccine in children aged 6 months to 5 years old. That's according to the Washington Post, which reports the request by Pfizer and its partner BioNTech could come far sooner than expected, and a decision by health regulators could come as early as the end of February. Meanwhile, the Food and Drug Administration's fully authorized Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine for use in U.S. adults. It's the second vaccine to get full FDA approval after Pfizer's mRNA vaccine won full authorization last August. The New York Times reports former President Trump directed his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, to ask the Department of Homeland Security if it could legally take control of voting machines in key swing states after Trump lost the 2020 election. The Times cited three anonymous sources who said Trump also explored proposals for two other government agencies, the Pentagon and the Justice Department, to seize voting machines in an effort to reverse his defeat. The Washington Post reports some of the White House records turned over to the National Archives to congressional investigators had been ripped up by Trump and then taped back together. Trump reportedly had a habit of tearing presidential records into shreds and tossing them on the floor in violation of the Presidential Records Act. CNN reports former Vice President Mike Pence's chief of staff, Mark Short, quietly testified last week before the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. Meanwhile, in Georgia, Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis has asked the FBI to provide security after Trump called on his supporters at a weekend rally to target what he called radical, vicious, racist prosecutors. Last week, a judge approved Willis's request to convene a special grand jury to investigate Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. She is an African-American woman. In Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis Monday lashed out at people who've called on him to condemn a series of Nazi demonstrations over the weekend near Orlando. DeSantis accused Democrats of trying to, quote, smear me as if I had something to do with it. His remarks came after his press secretary, Christina Pushaw, deleted a tweet suggesting the protesters weren't real Nazis and questioned whether they were Democrats in disguise. Meanwhile, police in Chicago have arrested a suspect in a string of apparent hate crimes targeting the Jewish community. The windows of two Jewish-owned Chicago businesses were smashed Saturday, while on Sunday, a synagogue and Jewish school were vandalized with swastika images and anti-Semitic graffiti. Amnesty International has published a new report accusing Israel of carrying out the crime of apartheid against Palestinians. Amnesty Secretary General Agnes Callamard told reporters in occupied East Jerusalem today, Israel's treatment of Palestinians constitutes a cruel system of domination and a crime against humanity.
We are here today to call on the international community to take resolute action against the crime of humanity being perpetrated in order to maintain the system of apartheid.
Israeli officials had demanded Amnesty International not release the report, calling its findings false, biased, and anti-Semitic. In related news, three Israeli military officers are being disciplined over their involvement in the January death of a 78-year-old Palestinian-American man in the West Bank. Two were removed from their positions, and the third will be formally censured. None have been criminally charged. Omar Assad died of a stress-induced heart attack after being bound and gagged and held in a cold construction site by the Israeli soldiers who detained him at a checkpoint while he drove home. In immigration news, the Homeland Security Department confirmed Monday it will expel Venezuelan asylum seekers apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border to Colombia if they previously lived there. The Biden administration had already quietly begun returning Venezuelans to Colombia using a contested Trump-era so-called public health policy called Title 42, which allows U.S. immigration officials to remove asylum seekers without due process during the pandemic. In Mexico, journalist Roberto Toledo was assassinated in the state of Michoacán on Monday, the fourth Mexican media member killed in January alone. Toledo reported for the local news outlet Monitor Michoacán. The outlet's director denounced Toledo's murder in a video posted on social media and said their team had received several death threats.
Today, the threats were ultimately fulfilled. One of our colleagues lost his life at the hands of three people who shot him in a mean and cowardly manner. We are not armed. We do not carry weapons. Our only defense is our pen.
To see our segment on the murder of Mexican journalists, you can go to democracynow.org. Burma's military rulers have extended a state of emergency for another 6 months. Monday's announcement came just ahead of the first anniversary of the February 1st coup that deposed democratically elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Burmese military officials have threatened to bring charges of sedition and terrorism against businesses that join a silent strike today to protest the military dictatorship. Meanwhile, there were reports of scattered protests in the capital, Rangoon. UN human rights officials report at least 1,500 people are known to have been killed in the year of protests following the coup. In Brazil, over a dozen people, including seven children, have died in the state of Sao Paulo since Friday in landslides and flooding triggered by torrential rains. Some 500 families lost their homes. Meanwhile, in Ecuador, at least 11 people died and several others injured in Quito as cars, mud, rocks and tree trunks were swept away by flooding after a day of record rainfall Monday. The Biden administration said Monday it'll reinstate regulations on emissions of toxic mercury and other pollutants from coal and oil-fired power plants. The move reverses a rollback of environmental rules imposed by President Trump in April 2020. A federal appeals court has ruled an Arizona utility company can be held liable for violations of antitrust laws after it charged its customers higher rates for electricity if they chose to install solar panels on their rooftops. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found evidence that the Salt River Project utility company structured its pricing to unlawfully thwart competition from solar energy systems. Some Salt River Project customers in Phoenix saw their electricity prices rise by more than 60% after they installed solar panels on their homes. In labor news, the Workers United Union says workers at 16 more Starbucks locations around the United States petitioned the National Labor Relations Board for union elections Monday. That brings the number of Starbucks stores where workers are organizing to 54 across 19 states. In December, workers at a Buffalo Starbucks store successfully organized the first union at the coffee giant's 9,000 U.S. locations. In California, a Democratic lawmaker called off a vote Monday on whether to establish a single-payer universal health care system moments before the California State Assembly was scheduled to take up the bill. AB 1400, also known as the California Guaranteed Health Care for All Act, had failed to garner the support of enough Democrats, even though the party has a veto-proof majority in the California legislature. Progressives have vowed to fight to bring the bill to a vote in the next legislative session. The California Democratic Party Progressive Caucus responded, quote, "Health care is a human right, and in the midst of a global pandemic, our Democratic supermajority showed its true colors and its loyalty to the profits of the healthcare industry over the needs of their constituents," unquote. And in Georgia, a federal judge has rejected plea deals between federal prosecutors and two of the three white men convicted of murdering Ahmaud Arbery. The deals would have allowed Gregory and Travis McMichael to serve the first 30 years of their life sentences in a federal prison instead of a state prison and to avoid a federal trial scheduled for next week. Ahmaud's father, Marcus Arbery, Monday condemned the plea agreement, saying all three of his son's killers should face federal hate crimes charges.
"And we want 100% justice, not no half justice. because you got to think, if an African-American man would have did a white man like that, they were trying to kill him on the spot.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll look at the U.S.-NATO-Ukraine situation as Russia amasses troops on the Ukraine border and NATO and the United States send weapons to Ukraine. Can a war in Europe be averted? Stay with us.
I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow, it's cloud illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds. Moons and Junes and fairies wheels, the dizzy dancing way that you feel, as every fairy tale comes through. I've looked at love that way, but now it's just another show. And you leave them laughing when you go. And if you can, don't let me.
Both Sides Now by Joni Mitchell. She joined Neil Young in pulling her music from Spotify to protest the show of popular podcaster and COVID conspiracy theorist Joe Rogan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, the United States and Russia sparred Monday over the crisis in Ukraine at the United Nations Security Council. The United States accused Russia of preparing to invade Ukraine by amassing more than 100,000 troops on its border. But Russia rejected the charge, claiming it's the United States and NATO who are trying to push Russia into a war. Last week, President Biden ordered 8,500 U.S. troops to be on high alert. The U.S. and NATO allies are also shipping weapons to Ukraine. This is Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations.
The threats of aggression on the border of Ukraine, yes, on its border, is provocative. Our recognition of the facts on the ground is not provocative. The threats of action, if Russia's security demands aren't met, is provocative. Our encouraging diplomacy is not provocative. The provocations from Russia, not from us or other members of this council. Russia has assembled a massive military force of more than 100,000 troops along Ukraine's border. These are combat forces and special forces prepared to conduct offensive actions into Ukraine. This is the largest, hear me clearly, mobilization of troops in Europe in decades.
And this is Russia's ambassador to the United Nations addressing the UN Security Council.
The deployment of Russian troops within our own territory has frequently occurred on varying scales before and has not caused any hysterics whatsoever. Troops and servicemen who are in their own areas of deployment and barracks where they were before, they were not actually on the border. This deployment of Russian troops in our own territory is getting our Western and U.S. colleagues to say that there's going to be a planned military action and even an act of aggression. But the U.S. ambassador speaks as if that act of aggression has already taken place. I very carefully listened to her statement. The military action of Russia against Ukraine that they're all assuring us is going to take place in just a few weeks' time, if not a few days' time. There, however, is no proof of confirming such serious accusation whatsoever being put forward. However, it is not preventing people from whipping up hysteria to such an extent that an actual economic impact is already being felt by our Ukrainian neighbors.
The UN Security Council adjourned Monday without the body taking any action on the crisis in Ukraine. On the diplomatic front, U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken is speaking with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov by phone today. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte are both expected to visit Kiev today. Meanwhile, the Hungarian President Viktor Orban is set to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin today and hold a news conference with him. In Washington, U.S. senators are preparing to unveil a bill imposing what Senator Robert Menendez described as the mother of all sanctions, targeting Vladimir Putin, Russia banks, and other entities. Today, we're spending the hour talking to those we are rarely hearing from. Voices around the world calling for peace. We begin today's show with two guests. Volodymyr Yushchenko is a Ukrainian sociologist, a research associate at the Institute for East European Studies at the Free University of Berlin. He's joining us from the German city of Dresden. Also with us, Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the peace group Code Pink. Code Pink is one of 100 U.S. groups that released a statement today urging President Biden to end what they call the U.S. role in escalating the Ukraine crisis. Medea Benjamin, let's begin with you. As these talks are happening at the highest levels and Russia is amassing troops on the border with Ukraine and the U.S. and NATO countries are sending weapons to Ukraine, can you talk about if you hold out hope for peace and what you think that could look like?
I certainly hold out hope for peace, but I think it's going to take the people of the NATO countries, and especially the United States, to make their voices heard. We can't rely on the Democrats or Republicans. We have them falling over each other to see who will be the toughest on Russia, with the Democrat bill calling for $500 million of lethal aid to be expedited, and Nancy Pelosi saying she's going to fast-track this legislation. And these crushing sanctions that we've seen the U.S. impose on other countries like Venezuela, Cuba, Iran, that only hurt the ordinary people. So we have to make our voices heard, which is why we're calling for people to get out on Saturday, February 5th, in front of their federal buildings, state houses, offices of their congressional representatives, or anywhere, to say no to this escalation. And we say every day should be a day of action, calling and writing your congressional representatives and the White House. That's the only way they're going to hear that the American people do not want a war with Russia. And we have to be recognize this moment of history as one where we need the voice of the American people, not a peace movement, the American people in general, because we are all against going to war.
And Medea, I wanted to ask you, we've been hearing now for weeks the same story repeated in almost every newscast, 100,000 Russian troops on the Ukrainian border. No one talks about the fact that there are 320,000 American troops still in Europe, 30 years after the collapse of the Soviet bloc. And those troops are somehow not considered a problem or a threat. Who are they there for, those 320,000 troops?
Well, that's right, Juan. I think this is a moment to educate the American people about all of the bases that the U.S. has surrounding Russia. What if Russia had bases in Mexico and Canada with missiles that were pointed at the United States? This is an educational moment to, and I'm glad you're spending the hour on it, talking about NATO and how NATO has expanded from 16 members at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union to 30 members, including members that were part of the Soviet Republic, and how Ukraine has a 1,300-mile border with Russia. And of course, this is extremely intimidating. And so I go back to saying the American people have to recognize how the U.S. is the expansionist country that has bases all over the world, and that NATO is antagonizing not only Russia, but it's antagonizing China. It says that China is a threat to NATO security. That's the North American Treaty Organization. China is in the Pacific. So it is a moment to say, not only do we want Ukraine not to be part of NATO, but we want NATO disbanded. And you can go to the Code Pink website and see all kinds of ways that you can get involved in this peace movement right now.
And Medea, do you have contact with peace movements either in the Ukraine or in Russia that are, what are they telling you about their concerns about this growing drumbeat for war?
Well, we are part of a movement that is called No to NATO, and we have reached out to groups in Russia, in Ukraine, and they are all saying the same thing. Nobody wants to go to war. There are many people in Ukraine that are worried about Russia, but they say war is not the answer. We know that the only ones who benefit from war are the military-industrial complex, the media that has been so sensationalist and increases its ratings. And that's why people in Ukraine itself are saying, slow down, step back. And of course, the people of Russia saying the same thing.
So let's bring in Volodymyr Yashchenko, the Ukrainian sociologist with the Institute for East European Studies. If you can talk about the response right now of Ukraine, what has been very interesting is last weekend when President Biden spoke with the Ukrainian president, it was reported that that call did not go well and that Zelensky was saying, you are blowing this up. You're going to lead us to war. I mean, he pulled back on that when he was asked, you know, about it. Had to put out another statement. But that was a report behind the scenes. Can you talk about what's happening in Ukraine right now and where the peace movement there stands?
Good morning. There is quite a consolidated position of the Ukrainian government right now that tries to goes against this mainstream narrative about the imminent invasion. And Zelensky, but not only Zelensky, the Minister of Defense, the Secretary of the National Security Council, they all tell that according to Ukrainian data, according to Ukrainian intelligence, they don't see the massive invasion to Ukraine with occupation of the large territory of the big cities as likely, not only in the coming weeks, but maybe like in this year at least. So that's what the Ukrainian intelligence says. And I mean, some people may say that like Ukrainian government may be lying and maybe hiding the truth. And we usually hear these conspiracy theories. I mean, at the same time, there are no like patriotic dissenting officers for military or intelligence saying that, okay, we have some traitors in the government that are just lying to the public and we need to be prepared to invasion like tomorrow or next week. So it looks like that there is some kind of indeed a discrepancy of the interpretation, and the reason that pushes us to the conclusion that the on the one side, there is this coercive diplomacy by Russia that involves military build-ups and all the diplomatic actions, diplomatic demands to NATO and the United States. But on the other side, there is a media campaign driven by U.S. Officials and media, but also now by the U.K. officials and media, that is developing by its own logic and is kind of like in a mutual reinforcement with the Russian coercive diplomacy. And for Ukraine, it already means quite serious economic risks. It destabilizes the national currency. The investors, for example, the real estate market are starting to move away, taking their money from Ukraine. And of course, the government feels that this panic may have probably the serious economic consequences right here, right now, even before Russia actually did anything particularly aggressive this year. And finally, the government may feel, and again, that's at a speculative level so far, that the West might try to force Ukraine to, in order to implement the Minsk Accords, the peace accords that the Ukrainian government actually doesn't want to implement for various reasons. One of them is that you may fear for the violent revolt from the nationalist civil society that perceived the peaceful accords as capitulation of Ukraine, although they are speaking on behalf of just one part of Ukraine, not of the whole country.
And Mr. Yushchenko, I wanted to ask you particularly about that, the right wing within Ukraine. President Putin has alleged that there's a significant Nazi and ultra-right movement within Ukraine. Could you talk about groups like the Freedom Party, Svoboda? How big are they? How influential are they within the Ukrainian government?
They are not relevant electorally at this moment. So Svoboda was able to get into the parliament during one election campaign, and was like 10 years ago. However, since that time, they were losing elections, Some of the people connected to the far right were present on the lists of nominally non-far right parties, but the real strength of extreme right in Ukraine is on the streets. They are probably the most mobilized, the most organized, the most politically articulated and actually armed part of Ukrainian civil society. The problem is that they also have quite significant legitimacy from other parts of the civil society and of the political society who are like nominally non-far right. However, they systematically downplay the extremism of that far right segment, downplay the strengths, downplay the danger. And it's kind of like a whitewashing of Ukrainian civil society, which is specifically directed to the West, in order to sustain all the support, all the sanctions against Russia, and so on and so forth. So the Ukrainian far right are strong at the streets, not really strong so much at the electoral level. However, it also due to their strength, they are capable to influence the policies of the government, and particularly about the implementation of the Minsk Accords. The far-right activists who blew a grenade near the parliament in 2015, they basically stalled the implementation of the Minsk Accords right after they were signed. And in 2019, when Zelensky had a huge support from the society, over 70% of trust, and just winning a landslide against Poroshenko at the presidential elections, winning a single-party majority at the parliamentarian elections, he was not able to make a progress with the implementation of the Minsk Accords, although even supported by France and Germany. Because of quite small but very voiceful so-called anti-capitulation campaign led by the National Civil Society, not only by the nominally far-right party, but also by professional NGOs perceived by liberal, however, in close connections and in close cooperation with the far-right segment, and at the same time supported by the Western donors, by the Western governments.
I wanted to ask Medea Benjamin about the role of military contractors here and what they have to gain right now. Several executives for U.S. military contractors have boasted that the worsening conflict in Ukraine is boosting their profits. This is Raytheon CEO Greg Hayes speaking last week during an earnings conference call with investors.
Yeah, the answer is obviously we are seeing I would say, opportunities for international sales. We just have to look to last week where we saw the drone attack in the UAE, which attacked some of their facilities. And, of course, the tensions in Eastern Europe, the tensions in the South China Sea, all of those things are putting pressure on some of the defense spending over there. So I fully expect we're going to see some benefit from it.
Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics all fund the Center for Strategic and International Studies, an influential think tank that supported U.S. military action in response to a Russian invasion. And, of course, you go back to the famous promise that then Secretary of State James Baker made to Gorbachev. When was it? In 1990, saying not one inch eastward, that promise that NATO would not expand to Russia's border. Medea Benjamin, if you can talk about what we hear in the United States on the corporate networks, the lack of presence of those who are opposed to a war with Russia.
Well, first, I think it's very important that you bring out who in these defense contractors and military contractors, more accurately, are benefiting from this. We have given over $3 billion in, quote, lethal aid to Ukraine since the 2014 coup. And the NATO alliance itself, you know, there are some organizations that come together to do things like reduce poverty or greenhouse gases. The NATO alliance has a goal of increasing the percentage of the GDP that countries spend on the military. It's actually a goal. Only 10 of the 30 so far have reached that goal. And there is pressure on those deadbeat countries that prefer to put money into education and healthcare instead of buying fighter jets and bombs. So NATO itself is really doing the bidding of the military-industrial complex. And so the media is another winner in this. Their ratings go up. They have sensationalized this. And as you said, they don't put voices of the peace movement. And I do want to say that we need the progressives in Congress to speak out more because they have more access to the media than we do. There is a statement that was put out by Pramila Jayapal from the head of the Progressive Caucus and Barbara Lee, but it wasn't signed by the whole Progressive Caucus. It was just the two of them. Where are the rest of the over 100 members of Congress that call themselves progressives? We need to hear their voices, and we need to hear them on the media, loud and clear, representing us, saying, stop this escalation of war. We need the money not to be spent on more bombs, but that money to be spent here at home to improve people's lives.
And Medea, I wanted to ask you, the U.S. government has not only had trouble rallying the government in Ukraine behind its current posture toward Russia, but also with among its own NATO allies. I'm wondering if your talks with other peace groups around the around Europe, what the hope is for whether any of the major European powers will put the brakes on the drumbeat for war that is going on now.
Certainly the government of Germany and France have been better than the United States, but there is so much pressure from the U.S. on NATO to come out in unity on this. And that's why it's so important to hear from the peace groups that are very active in the European countries, particularly in places like Germany and France. It's civil society in those countries that are forcing their governments to try to take a stance that is not as aggressive as the United States. Unfortunately, we don't have that same kind of pressure on our government, which is what we need to do right now. It is our moment now to show our European allies, the civil society in those countries, that we too can put that kind of pressure on our government.
And the day of action, Peace with Russia Day of Action that you have planned for February 5th, what is that?
It was just called. You can go on the CodePink.org website and register your own protest. You only need yourself and a group of friends to do that, but we need people all over the country. And then we're really saying that every day is a day of protest. Our friends, the Code Pink group in San Francisco, is going to the home of Nancy Pelosi because she's supposed to represent us, and yet she is calling for expediting of this legislation that would send more weapons to Ukraine. And so I think it's fair to go not only to the offices of our representatives, but if necessary, to go to their homes. They are not doing their job. Of course, Anthony Blinken, who is supposed to be the top diplomat in the United States as Secretary of State, is not doing his job. But neither are all of those who are supposed to be our representatives. They are not doing their job of calling on the Biden administration to stop this drumbeat for war. And so it really is up to us, February 5th, the time to get out, but call, write, and not only the Congress, but also the media to tell them that we want to hear the other side in this conflict, the side that is calling for de-escalation, negotiations, no war.
We want to thank you for being with us, Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, and Volodymyr Shenko, the Ukrainian sociologist, Institute for East European Studies at the Free University of Berlin. When we come back, we are going to look at the peace movement in Germany and also in Belgium, the home of NATO. Stay with us.
Зоркие окна, кто согреет зоркие окна? Пожалей беззвучными словами своего лавенного Христа. Жадные пальцы, кто накормит жадные пальцы? Обними голодными руками своего неспасенного Христа. Беглые тени, кто поймает беглые тени? Спеленай надежными цепями своего безнадежного Христа.
Gospel by Igor Letov and his band. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue to look at voices for peace amidst the tensions over Ukraine, as we go now to Germany, where the new coalition government has refused to send weapons to Ukraine, even as the United States and other European nations have sent military support. Germany also banned Estonia from supplying German-origin howitzer weapons to Ukraine. Germany did send Ukraine 5,000 combat helmets last week to help protect soldiers in case of an attack by Russia. Germany's defense minister said the move was a signal to Ukraine that, quote, we are on your side, but the move was ridiculed by others calling for a stronger stance, sending active military weapons. This comes as the head of the German Navy resigned this month after he made comments that downplayed the crisis, saying Russian President Vladimir Putin deserved respect. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has promised his country is in tune with EU and NATO policies towards Russia, but insisted, quote, we don't provide any lethal weapons. Scholz spoke earlier this month at the World Economic Forum.
The Russian side is aware of our determination. I hope they also realize that the gains of cooperation outweigh the price of further confrontation. This is the basis on which we are engaging, because we strongly believe that global public goods can only be preserved through international cooperation, and peace is the most important one of them.
For more, we're going to Berlin, Germany, to speak with Rainer Braun, the executive director of the International Peace Bureau. He's a German peace activist, an historian, and author who's campaigned against the U.S. airbase in Ramstein and against NATO. also with us in Belgium, where NATO is based, is Ludo de Brabander, spokesperson for a peace organization based in Belgium, which works with the global coalition No to War, No to NATO, which organizes an annual NATO counter summit. We welcome you both to Democracy Now. Rainer Braun, let's begin with you. You know, we're looking now at a post-Angela Merkel Germany at this moment in time with this escalation of militarism towards Russia in regards to Ukraine. Talk about the German peace movement and where it stands right now and what this new government is about, which is in coalition with the Greens.
You know, the new German government has two parties, which are totally anti-Russian parties. These are the Greens and the Liberals. And both are trying to push the German politics more against aggressive behavior to Russia. This includes no to the pipeline. This includes the stop of sending military equipment to Ukraine. This means more confrontation. And the German peace movement is campaigning for peaceful relations to Russia, for a politics of common security, for negotiations, and for fulfilling the obligations of the Minsk II agreement. For us, the Minsk II agreement, which first said we need a new constitution in Ukraine, which make the country much more federal. We need negotiations between the two parts of Ukraine. We need elections in the Ukraine, and then come also to a new border control, is the key point for a peaceful solution of the conflict. And the Ukraine government is doing the opposite of this. They're always trying to put more troops, more weapons to the borders, more maneuvers. 2.5 billion of US dollars is a support from the US for this aggressive US government. So what is the peace movement doing is to looking for a policy of common security, for negotiations, and for mobilizing the people for peace against the very intensive war-oriented media campaign in our country.
And I'd like to ask you, Rainer Braun, in terms that you mentioned the Minsk II agreement, to what degree is that agreement basically a threat to the hegemony of the United States, seeing as it was Europe trying to solve its own problems?
It was the try of Europe to solve the problem with the Normandy discussion forum, which include Russia and the two parts of Ukraine and France and Germany, and which exclude the United States, because the United States has very specific aggressive interests in Ukraine and in opposite to a policy of common security and negotiations in Europe. Russia was always trying to negotiate with the Europeans. And it is one of the biggest mistakes of the European countries to deny these negotiations and go to the support of the US confrontation of politics. And we hope that with the movement of the people, we come again to a more inclusive European politics, which is continue the politics of the OSCE, of the period of the 80s and the 90s, where we have a common politics with Russia at many points. And this was a peaceful part of German European history. And we have to come back to that, because the opposition is war in Central Europe. Can you imagine what a war in Central Europe with the high technology development of all this means? This means the destroyment of Central Europe. And I cannot imagine that this war will be in the end working without nuclear weapons. And this means really the end of Europe. So the key point is, are we coming back to a more peaceful European politics, or are we coming together in supporting the US confrontation of politics to more aggressions and more war-oriented against Ukraine and against Russia?
And in terms of the, there's been much made of the Nord 2 pipeline that has been completed but not yet certified for operation in terms of the influence that has on Germany. Could you talk about that in relationship to this crisis?
You know, the pipeline is an open question. I have many ecological problems with these pipelines. But in reality, these pipelines saved the energy security for Europe, above all in these times where energy becomes much more expensive. We had 50 years relations of energy to Russia and to the former Soviet Union. And always Soviet Union or Russia was fulfilling all their obligations to quite good prices. So we need these pipelines as an element of cooperation in opposition to the confrontation. And let me say one example for the confrontation. It is always said that the Russian troops are nearer to the border to Ukraine. They are 350 kilometers far away from the border to Ukraine. But the NATO troops, including German troops, including US, Canada, and British troops, they are 150 kilometers far away from St. Petersburg, a historical city of Russia. Who is in aggression to whom when you are looking to these faces? And again, NATO is spending $1.1 trillion for military purposes. Russia is spending $65 billion. For military purposes. Can you imagine that a country whose military budget is 1/14 of the budget of the other will be the aggressor? These are stupid stories which only show that the aggression comes from the NATO.
Rainer Braun, if you could talk about the assessment that the U.S. analysts and the corporate media often give of this post-miracle government. They're just trying to get their feet on the ground. They're very wishy-washy, but they'll get it together. And finally, they will join with the United States. They've been very wishy-washy until this point. Would you assess them in that way? Or would you say they're taking a completely different approach because they don't want to send active military weapons to or be involved with a real military incursion?
You know, in reality, all these countries are a part of NATO. And the NATO enlargement is the background of the crisis and the aggressions of the Western countries to the East. So there are definitely differences between the US and the European countries. But there are many common points. And one main common point is that they want to include the Ukraine in the Western system, on the European Union level and also on the NATO level. And these are geostrategic reasons, geostrategic arguments and facts. Ukraine is a very important part in the whole Eurasia game. Who are the main influence in Eurasia? Brzezinski was writing, who has Ukraine under control is on one side controlling the way between Europe and Asia, and on the other side is weakening Russia. And there's a common interest of the US and Europeans. That is to weaken Russia and not to accept the Russian military and the Russian national interest. And that is the background of these deep, deep crises. So there are differences, but there are also many common points between the U.S. and Europeans.
We want to bring in addition to Rainer Braun, go to Belgium, where we're joined by Ludo de Brander, who is with the group Vrede, which is the Flemish word for peace. If you are the country that is the home base of NATO, talk about the response there.
Well, as you said, Belgium is hosting in Brussels the headquarters of NATO and also is the capital, let's say, from the European Union, with the Commission, for example, his headquarters in Brussels. So, it's similar to what Rainer said concerning Germany. You know, the first thing that our government says, and there are also Greens and Social Democrats in the government, is that we need to fulfill our obligations towards NATO. So, and if NATO asks us to deploy troops, for example, towards the Russian border, towards the east of Europe, then Belgium will do this. This is the message we are given. And maybe to give you an example how the Ukraine crisis is playing also into the, let's say, into the interests of the military-industrial complex and is used Just recently, last Friday, our government decided to increase military budgets, referring to the crisis with Russia, to 1.54% of the gross domestic product, which is an increase from 1.1 today. So it's about, in 8 years' time, 14 billion euros, which is a lot of money, especially with the health crisis and the energy crisis now today. So, and you see, there is almost no debate in media. It seems like to be almost a political consensus that this one is needed. So, and I think this is due to the NATO policy and also to the propaganda. Almost we read and press their voices that are standing for peace and trying to give alternatives to military confrontation or almost not hurt. So this is a little bit the atmosphere in Belgium.
And Ludo de Brabander, I wanted to ask you, for those listeners here who may not be familiar with the origins and evolution of NATO, could you talk a little bit about the original reason why NATO was created and especially why it chose, following the collapse of the Soviet bloc, to expand eastward?
Well, NATO has, you know, when it was created in 49, it was to keep the Russians out, the Germans down, and the United States in. That's the very famous phrase that is often used. And of course, the Warsaw Pact has been established 6 years later, but it was in the middle of, let's say, when Truman gave his speech in 47, let's say, that makes the difference, and that started the Cold War. It was like, yeah, always with accompanying what I call the propaganda of, we have to be careful for Russia, Russia will invade us. And like similar, that time similar to what happens now. And after, you know, it has already been said, I think, in the program today, but going further on in the 90s, when the Warsaw Pact was dissolved and the Soviet Union also became dissolved and with 10 states coming out of it, many in even mainstream politics thought NATO is not needed anymore. But NATO, it just the opposite happened. NATO, let's say, reinvented itself. It started in late 90s to expand its territory to the east. It changed, let's say, its policy of a pure defense organization to Article 5, you know, when one country is attacked, all countries will help and support the country attacked. This is the central, let's say, task of the NATO. Suddenly, there was talk about non-Article 5 tasks, which became intervention policy of NATO. And third, it started to be global by making a lot of cooperation agreements with countries and regions worldwide. So NATO reestablished itself as a global actor now, more and more, as a global force. And as Reiner said, NATO, more than half of military spending is done by NATO. And now you see a big push towards all NATO countries, because this was decided in Wales in 2014 to increase their defense military budgets. And it will become, even in a few years, 60-65% of all military expenditures in the world. And so it became very important military force. And I think mainly to defend geostrategical interests. It's not about security. If it would be about security, the relationship with Russia would be treated differently. As Reiner said before, then it would be more cooperative. We would look for what is called common security, because security is indivisible. Security of the other is in the interest of the security of the one. So it is, but this policy is undermined by NATO. This principle.
And to what degree is there an opportunity for the peace movement to be able to affect the policies of some of the key players, European players within NATO?
Well, it's very difficult. As I said, I mean, there is not much coverage of the positions of peace movement. What we try to do, we have to also, as media announced already in the United States on the 5th of December, of February, so next Saturday, a vigil in Brussels. And what we try to emphasize is that NATO is not in our interest, not in the interest of security and peace, but also not in the interest of, let's say, the needs of people. This announcement of military spending to increase it, this is what we try to use, because at the same time, there's a huge discussion in government, or we had a huge discussion in government, how to solve the bills of they go up 2, 3, 4 times up.
Ludo, we have energy. 10 seconds.
Okay, for energy and how to solve that. So we want to oppose that military spending to what the real needs of the people.
Ludo de Brabander is with the peace group Vrede, which is based in Belgium, where NATO is based. And thank you to Reiner Braun, who is with the International Peace Bureau, speaking to us from Berlin. Both will be involved with peace vigils as the escalation of militarism continues between Ukraine and Russia and the United States and NATO. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for kids, teens, or young adults. It's just not.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals and volatile organic compounds into your body.
And nicotine, the same highly addictive substance found in regular cigarettes.
Nicotine can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
Affecting learning, memory, attention, and impulse control. And priming the brain for other addictions.
Vaping products also come in kid-friendly flavors that can make them appealing to youth.
And many kids also use other drugs, like marijuana, in vaping devices.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media,
many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping, because when you talk, they hear you.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Thank you.
Thank you.